Hello and welcome to the menu on Monocle 24. I am Marcus Hippi. This week, British chef James Martin discusses the joys of cooking with butter.
We have this obsession with trends and stuff like that. Well, trends come and go, but good quality cooking will never ever die.
We're also in Portugal, where one family-owned port wine producer is getting an increasing amount of attention. Then we will visit one of Stockholm's best new cocktail bars.
Being a bar, we're also a consultancy firm when it comes to beverage programs, and we're also a bar shop. So everything in this building is essentially for sale.
And of course, we'll hear a dinner soundtrack recommendation too. That is all ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. Up first today, we turn our attention to one of life's simple pleasures, butter. British chef James Martin's latest book sheds a light on the importance and variation of this kitchen staple and contains a range of butter-centric recipes that include everything from baked goods to meats. Monocle's Charlie Field-McCourt recently spoke to James and began by asking why he decided to write the book.
I decided it during lockdown, really. I got approached by the publishers and they had an idea for another sort of home cooking book. And I went, really? I said, everybody's been cooped up at home for 2 years. They want something to get out. They don't want another home cooking book. And there'll be loads of chefs doing them. Sure enough, when we brought out the butter one, there's about another 50 chefs that's bringing out cooking at home and all together cooking. I just wanted to do a thing on ingredients because I've been a passionate supporter of the produce that we have in this country, the farmers that produce it and the people who make it. And this kind of all links in together. It's an ingredient that, I mean, people are familiar with what I've been using for over the years and they know that I like it. And I'm classically French trained. So the timing was probably about right.
And I guess that kind of explains it. But obviously, you know, butter, whether as an ingredient, but also as a focal point and just to be enjoyed on its own. How important is it for you, whether it's as an ingredient or as something that you can, you know, just have with a piece of bread? How important is it to you? And I guess as someone who is French trained, the answer is probably quite.
Yeah, because butter is not just butter. You look at it, there's so many different types. It's like cheese. It varies from season to season. You can get butter from a farm in the summer. It tastes very different to the same farm, the same cattle in the winter. It's all to do with what the cattle are eating. The terroir, they call it in France. The ground and the weather and the sunlight and the natural herbs in the grasses, that kind of stuff. It all denotes what type of dairy, what type of milk it is, what type of cream it is. And then obviously from the milk, you can get great cream. And from the cream, you get great butter. You get great cheese. So you'll so often find where there are good productions of cheese, you'll find great productions of butter because naturally it just goes in hand. And that's spread across the whole of the UK, in Scotland as well. There are a few artisan places that produce it better than any. So when you search out for those ones and you taste it, a bit like the French would do, you sort of value it and prize it. So that's what I wanted to do in the book, is show people that it's not just the butter you spread on your toast from the supermarket. Go out and see what else is out there. And it, you know, spend an extra 20p, 30p on a pack of butter and it'll taste totally different. Totally, totally different.
And you mentioned some of those, you know, high quality butter makers. Could you maybe talk us through a few of the UK's best?
One's called Ampersan, which is a lot of chefs would use that. It's a patisserie butter. The dry butter, which has had a lot of the buttermilk and the water pressed out of it, is what you would use for baking to make croissants and pain au chocolat, that kind of stuff. It almost snaps in half like a chocolate bar. Then you go a little bit further around. You've got Neverend butter, which is on the Gloucestershire sort of Welsh border. They use Cotswold cream. That's also fantastic. A small family. They supply everywhere from the Ritz to the Savoy. Amazing quality butter. Very, very different again. Bungay butters from Suffolk. They use cattle from Jura in France. The cattle that they use are famous for Robuchon and particularly this time of year of cheese called Vacheron Mont d'Or. Really rich, creamy. The cattle produce this amazing butter and they culture it warm. It's unpasteurized. It's served in a wooden box. A very old class way of making butter, flavored with sea salt. You've got the Edinburgh Butter Company. They've got their own sort of herd up there as well. They do the same thing. Montgomery Brothers, they produce amazing cheddar. That's down in Devon. There's so many. You've got Brittlesford Farm on the Isle of Wight. They've got an old Jersey cow's herd. They produce a really, really yellow butter. It's like buttercup, really bright, vivid yellow butter. But there's nothing in it. It's just the milk churned. That's all it is, or cream churned, and that produces the butter. So it's as pure as you're going to get.
There's evidently, as you say, huge variation across the regions in the UK. But one thing I noticed that was particularly interesting is that you said in the book that it's the most important ingredient in the kitchen. I mean, that's obviously quite a big statement, but why is this? Why do you think it holds such importance to a chef?
Well, that and salt, you know, seasoning, but butter is the fundamental part of classical cooking, if I want to pigeonhole it. But when we write in the book, I was quite fortunate to have a load of chefs come over and we did the Saturday show still from the house. And so I got them to write a little quote, and they've done everything from bathing butter I couldn't be without in my kitchen. These are all a cross-section of all the best chefs in the UK. So whether you're cooking at home with a little bit of toast or whether you're creating a meal in a three-star Michelin restaurant, you will have butter in that kitchen. It is the fundamental backbone in classical French cooking, and not just French cooking, classical British cooking, but classical cooking in general. And whether you go to Italy, whether you go to Spain, they still use butter, you know, wherever you go. Yes, there's substitutes. You can use olive oil and bits and pieces for certain things, but it's not the same. You know, you wouldn't take white sliced bread and dip it in olive oil. You take it and put it in butter. Having said that, focaccia with the most amazing extra virgin olive oil is just phenomenal. You wouldn't put butter on it. So everything has its place in a kitchen, but butter is always found in a fridge.
And moving on to the book itself, you initially go through a number of recipes for butter, but it also kind of branches out to how you can include butter within your cooking. Could you maybe just talk us through the book and maybe why you set it out that way?
First of all, it tells you the process of how it's made, and it's a very simple process of how it's made. You can take a 600ml tub of cream, which is a standard size thing of cream in a supermarket, and you just whisk it up beyond whipping cream and carry on going. And in about 2 or 3 minutes, you'll end up with butter as the buttermilk separates from the water and separates from the butter. So you end up with three products left. Buttermilk traditionally then is then sent as pig feed. And I was a pig farmer for 35 years. So you kind of know about that sort of game. And I wanted to teach people the basis of it started off with, and then it takes you through the flavored ones. And then it takes you from that, what to do with it. And it shows you to go out and hunt for certain bits and pieces and look for little small artisan producers, as well as showing you the classic ways of cooking it and show you that when you're cooking with butter, the reason why your cakes and bits and pieces may collapse is generally not the recipe. It's not you. It's the ingredients that you're using, be it the flour or the butter or whatever it is. It's usually the quality of the ingredients. It's as simple as that. And flour is another thing. You use really rubbish flour to create a cake and it will never work. The prime example of that, anybody that's ever seen Clarkson's Farm on Amazon at the moment, and he's producing this wheat and this barley, the reason why you get good money for it is that it's all to do with the protein, the gluten in the flour. The good stuff will fetch the money. That goes into a proper mill and that's sold as really good flour, which produces really good bread. It's the same thing with butter. You start off with the raw material, you can produce great food out of it. It's as simple as that.
And keeping with that kind of quality of ingredients, from what I gather, in your eyes, it seems that margarine is a bit of a forbidden word. Why can it never compare to the real thing for a chef? Why is it important to keep to the basics and to use these high quality products?
It's not high quality, you know, it's affordable, but margarine's not food. It never has been food. Anthony Bourdain, one of the greatest chefs ever around, we sadly lost him about 3 years ago. He had an amazing quote, said, "Margarine's not food. If you cook with margarine, I can't help you." It's a prime example. It's just rubbish. You know, what is margarine? Margarine is oil out of vegetables. First of all, how the hell do you get oil out of a vegetable? And then you then set it in a carton to make it spreadable. So what is in it? That's all I'm saying. I don't want to eat that sort of stuff. I want to eat natural quality stuff, and be it a little piece of fish out of the sea under the grill with a little bit of butter on it. That'll do for me. But yeah, margarine, it has no place in a good chef's kitchen.
Well, I can't argue with that. And speaking of good chef's kitchens, from what I've seen, butter is definitely being appreciated again. I mean, look in England, look across, you know, Michelin star restaurants, high-end restaurants. It's very common to see bread and butter on tasting menus. Why do you think this is?
One of the greatest chefs in the UK at the moment is a guy called Gareth Ward. He runs a restaurant called Inisir in Wales. One of his courses is bread and butter. It's slow-fermented bread. The butter is fermented. It's unbelievable. When you taste really, really good bread, it's one of the joys of being alive. And when you taste really good butter, that combination of the two, to me, it's one of the purest forms of eating, really. I just think chefs look at it and go, we're constantly developing in this country, wanting to be better and better and better. So let's not look at butter as something you just put on your toast and it just is what it is. Let's look for something that stands up as good as all the other ingredients that we use in our kitchen. Put the same care and attention to it that we do with everything else that we do. You know, even if I walk into a supermarket to see the vast selection of butters for sale, people are creatures of habit. You always go for the certain one that you like, because that's the one you have on your toast. But try something else, because there's some amazing stuff out there.
Do do you think that butter's resurgence goes hand in hand at all with the fact that we're seeing a resurgence in baking and, you know, people are wanting to eat better bread?
Well, you can't bake cakes without butter. Well, you can if the recipe hasn't got butter in it, but you can't bake cakes with margarine. If you think margarine's a butter substitute, then you're sadly deluded. But you can't bake without quality butter. So, yeah, everything has its place. But there's certain things you would cook with certain butters. You know, you don't just go to a supermarket and just buy random butter and just expect your croissants and your pan au chocolat and your brioche is going to come out as good as the French. It doesn't work like that. It's all to do with moisture content. It's all to do with, and this book, when I wrote it, it tells you what to look out for and what you want to do with it. If you want to create a pan au chocolat or a croissant, you get that from a place called Ampersand. You get it from the Edinburgh Butter Company. It's less moisture content. It's less buttermilk content. It's almost snaps in half. So when it's baked in the oven, it doesn't make your cakes go soggy, but you get the most amazing butter flavor from it. So butter is not just butter. There's a whole subject there.
James Martin there in discussion with Monocle's Charlie Field McCord. James's new book, Butter, is out now. Let's then continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Maylie Evans.
Thanks, Marcus. First to Russia, where the first edition of the Russian Michelin Guide has been released. 69 restaurants feature on the list, with 7 winning 1-star and 2 restaurants with 2 stars. As the first Russian guide, it is an important marker for the country's culinary scene, and going forward it will reflect the development of the industry. Hopefully this will include more restaurants that serve traditional Russian food, as well as looking further afield outside of the capital. Elsewhere, there's good news for wine drinkers in the UK, as news comes in that a trade deal has been agreed between the nation and New Zealand. Although full details of the deal are yet to be announced, it's likely to incorporate a specific wine annex that will help remove barriers to trade. As the UK is New Zealand's second largest export market for wine, it's good news for Kiwi wine producers and the British fans of their wine. Travel between Singapore and the US is about to get much more comfortable, with a new collaboration between Singapore Airlines and Southern Californian wellness retreat, the Golden Door. Starting early next year, the partnership will offer new in-flight options for healthy dining, exercise, and strategies for better sleep. Food options will take into consideration how our taste buds are affected when flying. This will be a far cry from the regular fare we're used to on flights, which rely on salt and fat to create flavour. Instead, the Golden Door uses punchy combinations of herbs and spices for their dishes to take flight. And finally, residents in San Francisco will soon be able to experience the area's first brunch tasting menu. Hilda and Jesse in North Beach will include the option of a weekend 3-course tasting menu. The menu delivers an experience as elevated as fine dining, just with pancakes and avocado toast. You can expect the likes of white truffle on pancakes and porridge topped with fermented onion. Opening from the 1st of November, this is not somewhere to grab some simple beans on toast. That's all for today. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Maylie. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. Stockholm's bar scene has been given a shake and a stir recently, with a handful of new cocktail venues picking up some of the most prestigious bar awards in Europe. In Östermalm, the city's well-heeled business and high-end fashion district, a place literally named a bar called Gemma is leading the pack. Monocle's Maddie Savage went to get a taste of what's on offer.
I'm just heading towards a bar called Gemma. It's a couple of minutes' walk from Stureplan, where many of Stockholm's most luxurious bars, clubs and restaurants cluster together. A lot of them quite glitzy and bold. This street feels a little quieter and more understated. And it's here that in March 2019, two friends took a sledgehammer to a small neighbourhood cafe and transformed it into one of the city's most popular cocktail venues. Hello!
Hi! Hi, I'm Johan. I'm the owner here at the bar called Gemma. Super nice to have you guys here. And obviously, as you can see, we're just setting up for the Friday service. We produce somewhere between 300 and 350 drinks on a Friday. We only have 36 seats, so it's very, very electric in here, which is lovely.
tell me what you were setting out to do when you transformed this former coffee shop into a cocktail bar with leather seats, plants, low-hanging lamps.
Oscar Dragoris and myself started this project together. We were both working at bars at the time. We were working together. So after the shifts, we went here during the nights and basically painted, did all the cabling, designed. So it was a long and rough period. Initially, the thought was just to create a very nice living room.
What was the initial reception?
A lot of people got amazed on how simple it actually is, because the design is very simple. The area which Gemma is located in, which is Östermalm, one of the more posher areas in the city, a lot of people felt that, why would you open a place designed like this over here? You should be in the south, right?
Southern neighborhood, Södermalm, former industrial area,
exactly.
Known for being a bit more where the creatives hang.
Sure, exactly. But then as soon as people sat down, people started to absolutely fall in love. We play music, which is rock and roll and blues, which has a big connection to my childhood. And a lot of people comment on the atmosphere of saying, like, it's so friendly here, you know, because at some other places, it can be quite rough here in the city where people don't really talk to each other. Whereas here, people just, you could tell when people sit down in the sofas, they kind of like have this long breathe out thing where they're like, okay, nice. I can just relax, you know?
Yeah, it is very soothing in here.
Yeah.
And you've had huge success with a string of awards. I'm just going to go through a couple of them. Best Cocktail Bar in Sweden 2020. That was at the Bartender's Choice Awards, one of the most prestigious prizes in the Nordic bar scene. Also recognised among the top 10 best new international cocktail bars in Europe. Tales of the Cocktail Foundation Spirited Awards, that was for. I could go on. Were you expecting this?
Just you reading that gives me goosebumps. We did not expect it. We didn't set out to win awards. We created a bar that we want to have. But obviously fantastic. We're super proud, super proud.
I want to ask you about the name, a bar called Gemma. Who is Gemma? Is it an ex-partner, sister, friend?
So Gemma is not an ex-partner. It's not an animal. It's actually an acronym of five words, which is the business philosophy. G stands for generosity, meaning there's nothing here we don't talk about. Our idea is that if we can inspire people, then the whole scene can become a lot better. Emotional, well, being at a bar should be emotional. And then you have the first M, which is multilateral. Being a bar, we're also a consultancy firm when it comes to beverage programs, and we're also a bar shop. So everything in this building is essentially for sale. Glassware, tools, everything.
So people can come here, get inspired, and take this vibe home with them.
Essentially, yes. Second M is for mindful. We think about everything we do in our program. When we talk about it, it's like everything from zero waste to sustainable. We're not a 100% sustainable or zero waste bar, but we think about it every single day. And A stands for artisan, meaning an artist. And it's the same words in Swedish. Generositet, emotionellt, medvetenhet, mångfald och artisteri.
Can we take a look at the menu?
Yeah, sure. It's right here.
So I'm looking for a mocktail today, and it's a very autumnal, crisp day. Mm-hmm. What might suit that mood for me?
I think you're going to enjoy the Cardinal, which is based on three spirits, Social Elixir, which is a phenomenal non-alcoholic product, quite umami-ish, rich, fresh pineapple, bergamot, and some bitter herbs.
So Oscar behind the bar is going to sort this out, your co-founder. Hi, Oscar.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Talking just briefly about the non-alcoholic cocktails, you know, we spend as much time on non-alcoholic as with alcohol, because it shouldn't be like a major decision if you want to be non-alcoholic, right? It shouldn't be just like, you know, I'm pregnant or I'm driving. It's just like the feeling around the table should be exactly the same whether you're drinking alcohol or not.
Oh, well, my mocktail's arrived with some fresh mint sticking out the top. Wow, that's delicious.
Thank you.
Really rich, full of flavor. Definitely autumn in a cup. You can taste the pineapple, but also it's kind of got a homely feel.
Mm-hmm. It's nice. I'm happy that you liked it.
So what are your ambitions? Will there be more bars called Gemma cropping up around Stockholm, around Sweden, around the world?
The short answer is yes. The longer answer is that we're actually in a expansion right now.
That sounds like a bit of a secret you can't quite tell us about yet.
No, exactly. It's going to be, it's definitely going to be out there in Europe, So yes, but it's super, super exciting. But obviously the whole expansion has been a little bit on hold because of the world situation, of course. And now we are enjoying that everything is, quotation, back to normal, that we actually got through this and we're still here. Because one thing which a lot of people don't know, there's no investor behind Gemma. There's no one just pushing in money. It's only me. So that's something that I just want to enjoy. And we'll see where we go from there.
Yeah, well, congratulations. We're coming up towards peak cocktail time. People in this neighbourhood starting to finish work, maybe heading here after an early bite to eat. So I'll leave you to finish off the preparations while I keep sipping on my Cardinal.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect.
Mary Savic reported from Stockholm's a bar called Gemma. You are with the menu. Next on the menu, we're off to Portugal to talk wine. For centuries, Porto has been home to aging cellars situated on the city's riverbanks, where visitors flock each year to sample the famed fortified wine known as Port. The wine takes its name from this city and is made with grapes grown in the nearby Douro Valley. While the trade has long been dominated by a group of large producers, many begun by British merchants and traditional port wine remains the main focus. One local family-run producer, Bosas, has recently found ways to bring novelties into the industry, even by keeping one eye on the past. Monocle's correspondent Ivan Cavallio visited the Bosas cellars in Porto and brought back this report.
Set on the south banks of the Douro River, across from downtown Porto, one encounters a sprawling collection of warehouses, where vast stocks of fortified wine slowly age in barrels, on the way to becoming fine tawny and vintage ports. Despite port wine's storied tradition, dating back centuries, some producers here are eager to shake up the wine's somewhat stuffy image. Pedro Poças Pintão is commercial director of Poças, a fourth-generation family winery looking to capture the attention and palate of today's generation of drinkers.
The story of Poças is anchored in port wine because that's how the company started 100 years ago. And port wine is an area where there's a lot of concentration in terms of ownership. So you have, well, five companies that actually have quite a dominance over the market. And so we always feel that in order to find our room, we need to do things differently. So we need to be bold and be able to create new wines, new visions of how to make wine. The fact that we are smaller also makes us also more agile to try to do things differently, to sometimes doing things differently is sometimes looking at the past. Portugal had former colonies, and so there was a wine called Quinado, which basically it's a port wine that is added with quinine. And that was used and drinking on those days because it was meant to be a prevention for malaria because of the quinine, right? Obviously, I mean, that tradition is long gone. And so we decided to recover that tradition. We still had some old stock of Quinado. And so we have released very, very slowly about 100 bottles a year of a very old Quinado. Quinado that has around 40 years old, even more than that. Another tradition that we have recovered, and that was a tradition also shared by other port wine companies, was the vermouth. There was vermouth production here in Gaia for a long time. The vermouth we probably stopped producing maybe in the 50s. And so 2 years ago, we have rediscovered this tradition of the vermouth. And what we did was we started with a white port wine base. And so we did a research of several botanicals from our estates in the Douro Valley. So we have about
100 hectares in the Douro Valley. And so we did a research about what kind of herbs, plants, fruits we had available in the Douro. And so we did a maceration of those herbs individually. So we tasted them and then we blended. We made a final blend where we have around 20 of those botanicals mixed with the white port wine base. And so it's a quite unique product.
The Bosas Superbo Vermouth, presented in a short stubby bottle called a pota, that was once commonly used to bottle port, has been a hit with those looking for something refreshing to sip before a meal. Pintown has also raised the profile of the Bosas label with the launch of Fuera de Serie, a niche collection of still wines that explores the potential of red and white Douro grape varieties.
Fuera de Serie is a special project where we give focus to a single varietal or to a process that for some reason they stand out from the norm. They stand out from everything else that we do. It can be a process that we recover from the past and that we now give a contemporary touch to it. And it's basically also a project that we don't feel the obligation to give for each of the wines individually a certain continuity. So for instance, 2018, there's a grape variety called Tinta Horiz, which is a very delicate grape variety, and the ripening conditions for Tinta Horiz are quite difficult. And so the harvest of 2018 had fantastic ripening conditions for this grape variety. And so we said, okay, so we're going to launch a wine that is made 100% by Tinta Horiz. But we don't feel the obligation to keep doing that in 2019 or 2020. So this was a result of the moment. So the moment was, yes, this was a fantastic year for Tinta Horiz. Let's make a variety of Tinta Horiz. Also, we're talking about very, very small productions. Some of these wines we produce sometimes 600 bottles. The maximum that we have achieved was probably around 4,000 with the orange wine, which is actually, then we're not talking about a variety, but we're talking about a process. So the orange wine, it's a white wine, but it's made with skin contact. Another wine that we, in a way, we recovered a little bit of a process from the past is a wine that we call Vinho da Roga, that we're going to actually taste. And the Vinho da Roga is some sort of memory of the time. Roga is basically the set of workers that go for the harvest, to do the harvest. And they were being paid, but they were also giving food and wine. And the kind of wine that usually the Roga were given was either a red wine diluted with water, or sometimes even a red wine that had a little bit of white wine inside of it. And so obviously today we're not going to do neither of those. We're not going to mix white or red, or we're going to dilute a red wine. But what we tried to do with this Vinho da Roga was like a deconstruction of this style of wine. So in a way, how would we do a Vinho da Roga if we're going to do a Vinho da Roga today? So we have less extraction, we have less skin contact, less alcohol as well. So in a way, we kind of paid homage to these days where the Roga, the group of workers that were working in the harvest, were given a very, very special wine.
Pintown offers a white wine fermented and aged in amphora, along with another called Acrobata, that uses indigenous grapes such as Arinto and Rabigato, and where the wine is transferred to old French oak barrels, where it remains in contact with fine lees prior to bottling. This autumn, he has four new releases for Fuera de Serie, including a Muscatel wine, and in future, he doesn't rule out adding a new port wine to the lineup to generate interest among wine connoisseurs. For Monocle, in Porto, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our Menu spin-off show Food Neighborhoods for great recipes. This show was co-produced by Charlie Filmacourt and Sophie Monahan Coombs and edited and mixed by David Stevens. I am Marcus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. This week we hear from Saint Etienne. This song is called Penelope. Thanks for listening.